On any given moment of any given day, if you're speaking with David Yarrow, it's going to be about holistic and sustainable living. The subject matter, however, we won't know until we are in the moment with him. We conclude our discussion with David Yarrow today. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries.
In 1976, I saw the CO2 curve, a graph showing the level of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere, now made famous by Al Gore in his movie, An Inconvenient Truth. And when I saw that curve in 1976, I recognized it as an exponential curve, and I realized that near the end of my lifetime, that curve would start to turn up very rapidly and probably get more vertical than horizontal, which meant that we would have a period of rapid and accelerating change on the planet. And here we are on the edge of this time now. But I saw that curve in 1976. I took it seriously. I paid attention, and by 1990, I saw enough information to convince me that climate change will be the number one issue of the 21st century. And I've always been concerned about one issue above all else, and that is how are we going to put fertility in the soil and grow food to feed our communities when we can no longer predict the weather and the climate and when we can no longer afford to burn all these fossil fuels. And this is what we're looking at now, is this time that I saw coming way back around 1976. I got the first glimmer of it, and by 1990, I realized here we are. So this has been my long-term concern, is how are we going to feed ourselves during this transition and how human beings are living on the planet? And so I've always focused on this question of how do we put fertility in the soil without resorting to all of these high-energy fossil fuel chemicals and other materials. And so I've been looking for this all my life. And in the year 2000, a retired naturopathic doctor sent me an out-of-print book about Dr. Maynard Murray and his work using sea solids or sea minerals in soil fertility and agriculture. And I realized that Dr. Maynard Murray had found a solution to this question. And so I wrote an article about Dr. Murray's research, and it was published by Acres USA 10 years ago, November 2001, and out of that came my communication with Bob Kane, and we agreed to start a business that would sell these sea minerals to farmers and begin to make Maynard Murray's research, his dream, come true. And so this has been a long-term concern of mine, is this question of during this coming ecological crisis and transition that human beings are going to be facing, how are we going to grow food? How are we going to make our soil fertile enough to create abundance and sustain our families and our communities in this historical period that we've now entered? And SeaAgra, the sea minerals, is an important piece of this answer to this question. It's not the only piece. There are certain other things that need to be done, too. But it's a fundamental part of the issue. The way I phrase it is that the fundamental question that we face is how do you take stones and turn them into bones? How do you take geology and transform it into biology? And the beginning of this question begins with the minerals, which are the stones or bones of the earth, if you like. And so we have to understand this process of how minerals become turned into living cells and protoplasm. And the first step in teaching growers organic methods or nutrient-dense methods or biological agriculture is to teach them how to get these minerals into their soil. And the sea minerals is a tremendous asset in order to put not just 6 or 8 or 10 or even 25 minerals, but all 90 elements that are needed by nature are in seawater. And so it provides a complete menu of all the minerals needed to make biology function.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Science has named 90, but there's a life force, obviously, within those 90, which creates, who knows what the real number is. I mean, science only has its one way to decide what is one element and what is another.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this is part of the cutting edge. The whole science of trace elements is only, at best, a century old, maybe 75 years old. And in the first 75 years, we learned something about perhaps around 20 elements are now identified as being trace elements that are needed at parts per million. But in the last 25 years, we've developed the technology in the laboratory to be able to evaluate minerals at parts per billion, even parts per trillion. And sure enough, we're discovering that certain elements are needed at parts per billion and parts per trillion. And we don't really understand these things yet, but in the last 20, 25 years, we have achieved insights due to our advanced chemical analysis methods to appreciate that biology seems to need more than just 25 or 30 elements. Biology does seem to need perhaps 60, 70, perhaps even all 90 elements that you can dissolve in water are essential for optimum biological function.
You mentioned that the sea minerals are part of the original start for getting good soil. Do you feel like biodynamic gardening is essential or parts of it?
Yeah, I have great respect for Rudolf Steiner, the man who taught biodynamic farming 100 years ago, 80 years ago. Steiner was a remarkable man in that he was a man who was an accomplished scientist, but he also was an accomplished mystic. And he was able to think with both sides of his brain, with his right and his left brain. And one of the things that this did was that one of the basic principles that he taught farmers is that your farm is an organism. In other words, he saw the farm as a living process, and he understood that it was a single, unified, whole living process. And he encouraged farmers to think of their farms in this holistic way. So Steiner was a man who was very much ahead of his time in terms of his way of thinking about these problems, much less with the kinds of solutions that he was offering farmers as a way to grow food. So I have tremendous respect for that. Unfortunately, I'm somewhat sad in that biodynamic farming has not really progressed a whole lot since Steiner imparted the basic principles. It's sort of been stuck in the original insights he provided. And there's been a few people that have come along that have added to what biodynamic farming is, but I'm afraid we need a lot more insight. We need to bring a lot more of our modern science to bear in order to understand these questions, which in Steiner's day, we didn't have the technology or the science to answer the questions. We had to rely on his mystical insight, which was quite good.
David, I would feel that you are someone that is progressing where Rudolf Steiner left off. Who else, or who would you say is someone that has developed more of the process?
Oh, dear, it would take a while to list everybody who's going down this path, and everybody's going down it in their own particular style and way.
You can just say one.
Well, one person that's here at Acres USA is Jerry Brunetti, is a man who's gained a lot of insight into the intimacies of biochemistry. And Hugh Lovell is another man who's teaching advanced biodynamic insights. So there's quite a few people. Part of my problem is that I'm from the Northeast, and Acres USA is a Midwest farming organization for the most part, so I'm something of a stranger in these parts. And I also don't know everybody here as well as I wished I had. I'm from the Northeast, where it's a whole different organization up there. We have the Northeast Organic Farming Association, and agriculture is generally smaller. One farm in the Northeast is as big as a whole field here in Kansas, for example.
I know. I moved from the East Coast to Texas at one point many years ago, and my dad had a 350-acre farm in upstate New York, which was fairly good size. But moving to Texas, if your ranch wasn't in the thousands of acres, it was considered very small.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or go to Australia, where there are 10,000-hectare farms out there.
Right. Yes. Well, before we move out of the sea mineral story, I loved your article on the dairy farmers. Can you share one piece about how the sea minerals have really enhanced things for the dairy farmers?
The Acres published my article in two parts, November and December. Part one ended with what I thought was one of the most elegant images of what this is all about. There was a dairy farmer in Pennsylvania that started feeding his cows sea minerals in December, 6 ounces a day. He rationed it to them through the wintertime when they were confined in the barn. And then, as he had done all his life, and even before him, his father, who was a dairy farmer on that same farm, had also, in the spring, turned the cows out into the pasture after winter confinement. And every year since he was a boy, this farmer, who's now in his 70s, had seen the cows come home from that first day back out in the pasture in the springtime with mud all over their noses, because they'd find a piece of bare ground and they were eating the dirt. They were eating mud. They were going at it so much they'd get it up in their nose and up into their cheeks and jowls. It was quite an amazing thing. Well, 3 years ago, after a winter of feeding 6 ounces of sea minerals as a daily ration, when they let the cows out into the pasture that spring, none of the cows came back with mud on their noses. They just stopped eating dirt. He said, "I don't know what's in those sea minerals, but whatever it is, it's giving the cows everything they need, because they're not interested in eating dirt. They just want to eat grass and make milk." And that's the kind of key insight into animal behavior, which shows that something very profound is happening when you start feeding this material to these animals. And there's a whole set of other observations that I've accumulated from farmers which indicate that feeding these minerals to animals or to plants or to soil causes very subtle but very dramatic changes in how those systems function. And I'm very happy to be able to share this and promote this idea to farmers, because it's not just going to make farmers more profitable. It's going to produce food which is stronger and healthier for human beings to eat, and it's going to produce soils which are able to fully function. And one of the primary functions of soil is to create the Earth's atmosphere. And it's a serious problem we have now, is the restoration of the balance of their atmosphere. And the soil is a key part of this system that needs to be regenerated. And teaching farmers to farm with sea minerals and with microorganisms is a key step towards restoring the whole planet.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I just talk about it all the time to people that might have some affiliation directly to the land and to animals. Let's flip over into a new topic with your experience regarding stray voltage and what it is, and is there a remedy needed or is there one in place?
Well, it's something that I know quite a bit about, but I'm no expert. I know quite a bit about it because I got electrocuted by a power line. I had 6,000 volts go through me, and I fell off the roof and broke my back. And so I had personal experience with stray voltages. It nearly killed me 19 years ago. But, the reality is that our electrical grid has not been very carefully designed and built. It's been put together as a patchwork of systems that were begun the turn of this last century and have slowly been added onto and expanded and diversified. And there has never really been a careful, thoughtful plan for how to make this massive power grid develop. And as it turns out, it's not working properly and it's leaking. I don't have any solid numbers I can offer, but some investigators think that up to half of the energy in our electrical power grid is leaking into the ground and forming underground return current paths. And so the electrical grid is injecting stray voltages and stray electrons into the earth and causing unknown kinds of disturbances and disruptions to the way nature functions and the way the ecology of the planet is operating. And this is well documented due to problems on dairy farms in the Midwest. It's been well documented by a variety of researchers that cows in barns that have leaking voltages, leaking currents, are being subjected to shocks. Some of them are microscopic shocks in the range of 1 to 5 volts. Sometimes they're pretty severe shocks to the point where it can actually cause an animal to have an unexplained heart attack and drop dead in the corral or in the barn.
Wow.
And these problems have been investigated. They've been documented. They have been fixed by people who are professional engineers and understand these issues. And it's a serious problem. This is what I was investigating when I was electrocuted, was this whole issue of stray voltages. And the key point in this investigation was that this one man, Mark Burmaster in Wisconsin, had been studying these problems for 15 years, and one day he was troubled trying to fix the problems on this one particular farm, and in the process of pondering why this farm had such persistent problems that didn't seem to be fixable, he came to a realization, an epiphany of insight, in which he realized that it wasn't isolated dairy barns out in the country, that the entire electrical grid is leaking, and it's affecting the houses where human beings are living, too. And he began looking at human housing situations and discovering the same symptoms of stray voltages and leaking electrons, and the same pattern of health problems in the human beings living in those houses that he had become quite aware of were affecting cows and dairy barns. And so this was a shocking insight that he came to, was this understanding that we have an electrical grid which is leaking into the earth and producing unknown and unevaluated, unmeasured effects on human beings, animals, insects, plants. We don't really understand these things. We're unfortunately not even willing to talk about them. It's very hard for most people to discuss these problems because they're simply too big and too overwhelming. It's like talking about climate change all over again. It's too big for most people to fit in their heads even.
Have you gotten some clues inwardly yourself?
How do you mean that?
Well, I just mean in fixing the situation or changing it somehow.
Yeah, well, this is something that I'm not expert in. Again, Spark, the man I was interviewing, Spark is the expert. He's the electrical engineer who studied these problems and is fully advised about them. My particular concern was just the general problem of electromagnetic pollution, which is a range of things ranging from the damaging effects of radar to cell phones to emissions from power lines and power transformers to radiation that's coming from our computer screens. All of these are sources of electromagnetic pollution which are unprecedented in human biological evolution and which are definitely impacting our physical bodies in ways that we don't understand. So this stray voltage problem on dairy farms and in human houses is just one aspect of this larger issue of the evolution and development of this electrical and magnetic technology and how it's impacting our health personally and also the environment in general. For example, there's a guy here at Acres USA, Bruce Tanio,
who
has developed technology in order to mitigate the effects of microwave towers on orchards because it's affecting the growth of trees when they have these microwave towers nearby.
Yes, he's been a guest on Tributaries a few times in the past.
Good.
Yeah, he's amazing.
He is.
Well, I want to keep you for a few more minutes, and I'm wondering if you would tell the Scandinavian legend of Ouroboros.
Oh, or you want to go up to the far mystical end of things.
Well, we have to we separate.
This is one of the great mysteries of our time. In England, for example, King Arthur of the Round Table fame, King Arthur and Guinevere and the Knights of the Round Table, the herald on the shield of Arthur was a dragon. His father was Uther Pendragon, which in Welsh means the great dragon. And so the dragon was an image of the royal throne in Britain for a long time, the Welsh. And today, Wales is still the only nation on earth with a dragon on its flag. This was not something that was unique to Britain, but actually was a global shared piece of human culture a few thousand years ago. For you mentioned Ouroboros. So in Northern Europe, in Scandinavia, which includes, of course, the British Isles, one of their common legends of how the world was made describes that there was a great dragon flying through the heavens. And the legend says that at a certain point, the dragon became tired and weary and curled up into a ball and went to sleep. And the earth formed on the skin of this dragon. And we are living, therefore, on the skin of a sleeping dragon. And the legend says that someday the dragon will awaken and continue its journey. And if you go to Australia, there the indigenous people talk about the rainbow serpent that flies through the heavens and visits their sacred sites. So the indigenous people of Australia, they know about dragons. The rainbow serpent is their version of a dragon. In China, the symbol of the emperor of China was the dragon. Only the emperor could wear the dragon robe. And even in America here, I remember I was at Cahokia, which is across the river from St. Louis. It's a World Heritage Site with all these earthworks, including the largest earthwork structure in the New World. It's a monk's mound. It covers 16 acres and 120-foot-high man-made earthwork. Anyway, the archaeologist at this World Heritage Site had excavated a bowl, and in the bottom of the bowl, it showed this snake coiling around so that the snake was chasing its tail. Except this particular snake in the bottom of this bowl had wings on its back, so this was not an ordinary snake. This was a winged serpent. This was a dragon. So even the people that built these earthworks in St. Louis in the Mississippi Valley in America, they also knew about this mystical creature called the dragon. And yet in today's world, the dragons are considered to be childish fantasies and of no consequence at all. But in ancient cultures, the dragon was a symbol for a certain quality of energy or intelligence, a certain type of power that is responsible for creating the universe that we live in, or more specifically, the world that we ride on here. Mm. And so the dragon is a forgotten archetype of spiritual power, which has been in eclipse in our culture for quite a few centuries. And it's very poorly understood and actually, I would state, is actively misunderstood by most people. Yeah. And this is real tragic because this goes back to what I said earlier, that it is the birthright of every human being to achieve spiritual enlightenment. It is part of our path in life to be, as I said, a young person and an adult. And then as an elder, we begin our spiritual path and we begin to turn inwards and develop our spiritual understanding of life. And this is part of the role of elders, is to uphold this part of our culture in society. So when I was in the hospital and I was electrocuted, I asked everyone I could, where did the symbol of medicine come from and what does it mean? And nobody could answer that question, which I thought was pretty tragic as a statement on how much we understand the sources of wisdom and knowledge. And the symbol for medicine, they show it on TV news every night when they do the medical and health news. So everybody sees this thing, but nobody understands it anymore. What you have is you have an erect rod, a staff, and then there are two snakes that climb up it, coiling around it and crisscrossing back and forth. And then at the top of the staff, there are two wings, usually thought of as the wings of an eagle. And so this was originally the staff of Mercury, the messenger of the gods in Roman mythology. But the Romans borrowed him from the Greeks, who called him Hermes. And the Hermes borrowed him from the Egyptians, who called him Thoth. And Thoth was the founder of the mystery schools of ancient Egypt. And the reality of what the symbol is that Thoth taught a discipline to cause the two serpents to coil at the base of your spine, to climb up your spinal axis, and then when they reach the top of your spine, which is the reptile in your physiology, it is the lower brain of our nervous system. When these two serpents reach the top of your spine, which is your pineal gland, then above them, sitting crouched in your cranium, is your higher brain, or your eagle. And so the eagle and the serpent become united if you practice the discipline that was taught by Thoth in the ancient mystery schools. And so the eagle and the serpent unite to become the winged serpent, which is the dragon. So although I never said this to anybody in the hospital 19 years ago when I was electrocuted, the symbol for medicine is the sign of the dragon. And this is part of our own birthright, is to awaken our own dragon so that we can achieve spiritual awareness and enlightenment. This is part of the destiny of human beings, which is currently being denied us because, first of all, we don't live long enough, and second of all, we don't have the culture to support this kind of spiritual development. And yet, I think we're on the edge of a time now where maybe we can begin to fulfill this potential again. Even as we're learning to put sea minerals in soil in order to grow food that has superior nutritional content, if we can begin to eat that food, our bodies may achieve their optimum growth and development, and we may start to live to be 100 years old or 120 or even 150 years old, as biology now thinks is a human potential. And in that condition, perhaps we can have elders in the world who do achieve spiritual enlightenment and do function as leaders to guide the way we're living on the planet again. This question you brought up about the dragon, as you can see, opens up into some very fundamental and primary issues of our time. How are we living? How do we understand is the goal of our journey on the earth? And what are these spiritual forces that are here to guide and enlighten us?
I appreciate that you brought us full circle here with the interview. It's been quite wonderful.
Yes, well, thank you for asking such pointed questions. It certainly covered a real, what should we call it, unusual array of diverse issues here. Everything from farming to the dragon.
I've been wanting this interview for a long, long time. So glad we could finally share David Yarrow's insight. To reach David, dyarrow.org. And for any guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.